And so we return from a week of vacation, our first ever vacation, John Shannon, since we started doing this little episode.
It was hard to come back to work.
Well, I was going to say on a daily basis, but we, you know, even before we were doing it on a daily basis, when we were just doing 3 days a week, we didn't take any time off. So no. What'd you do?
Well, I played a little golf. Yeah, a couple times. But it just, hey, you know what? Just relaxed. The weather was good. Nice in the backyard. Nothing special.
Well, I actually played golf as well. I went up to Taboo, one of my favorite places. I assume you've been up there.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And
it's a good spot. It's great. I love that golf course.
Oh, it's a great golf course. My friend Nigel Hollidge runs it. And happy to see him and to play the golf course. He tells me Jack Nicklaus was there a week ago, and they are going to redo the existing course and also build another 18.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they got the land, right?
They've got 1,800 acres.
Yeah, yeah.
And the existing golf course is on 300 acres, which is a huge piece of property for a golf course. So they got lots of land. And Taboo was, I think, the last course designed by Pete Dye.
Oh, really?
And so Nicklaus wants, you know, now they're going to bring Nicklaus in to redo it. And I think, and a lot, he tells me a lot of it is because of Jack's admiration for Pete Dye and the work that he did. And he's, you know, he's made tremendous golf courses all over the world. Not the least of which, I guess, is the TPC course, where they play the Tournament Players Championship.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, we got lots to talk about today. It's just John and I today, by the way. We hope you're enjoying your Labor Day, if that's when you are watching or listening to us. You were going to say something?
No, this was a day that to come back, there was so much to talk about. It would be difficult to squeeze in a guest almost. And you know what? Everybody deserves one last day off except us.
I don't see how that's reasonable, but
well.
Since I was talking about golf a little bit, let's start with that. The Tour Championship ended yesterday. The FedEx Cup, if you will, $15 million to first place for first place to Cantlay, and a deserving winner. He played great. I think I saw a stat. I think his last 15 rounds have all been under 70.
Yeah,
like 15 consecutive tour rounds, all under 70. That's really remarkable.
When you consider, though, what happened with the FedEx Cup and what happened the last three or four weeks was, I mean, it's like the CFL season. You got hot at the right time. I mean, and that's exactly what happened. He got hot at the right time. You know, he won four tournaments this year. He had a great season. But to play as well as he did in consecutive weeks over the playoffs was pretty impressive. And John Rahm just, you know, every week made a bad mistake at the wrong time, and yeah, one error every once in a while.
Well, here's my point on, and I understand the notion of a year-end championship. It used to be last four tournaments of the year. Now it's the last three.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. What I don't get is this point system that they insist on using. And now the point system during the course of the year, I guess, is fine. You got to figure out who the top, however many, I don't even remember how many, 125?
125, yeah.
At the beginning. And then they cut to 60, then they cut to 30. That's all well and good. I have no issue with that. My point is, this is a game that is judged by total score under par. Or two par. And now suddenly points become a factor in this. Points to get in, that's fine. But once these three events commence, why don't we just add up the scores for those three events? Have a winner for each event and then have the total score overall. Instead of creating this nonsense where Cantlay got 10 under par to start, and the second place guy I think was 8 under, and then mm-hmm. it goes down from there. And if you get far enough down, you just start at even. But that seems to be ridiculous to me. And, you know, I can follow scores. So if the guy wins at 60 under par for 3 events, who cares?
Right.
We understand that it's 3 different events. It doesn't diminish the significance of the events. And then it's pure stroke play, but instead of over 72 holes, it'd be over 216 holes. What do mm-hmm. you think?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I mean, let's face it, what the PGA and their sponsors have done, they've tweaked the rules every year, almost every year, in order to try to make it more understandable. And perhaps we're getting to that point, Bob. Perhaps we're getting to the three tournament total par tournament at a certain point. The bigger concern I think for the PGA is are the big names in the tournaments long enough? And you know, golf in many ways has been such a star-driven sport. How do you keep big names current in your tournament, in your playoff play? And that, to me, that's always going to be the big challenge that the PGA has in order to try to stay relevant this time of year.
But look, if you look at the Atlanta event.
Sure.
Look at the leaderboard. I mean, Cantlay had a great year. Mm-hmm. He deserved to be there. Rahm is the number one player in the world right now. Thomas was on the leaderboard. Kevin Na is a good, really good player. He was on the leaderboard.
Recognizable name, certainly, yeah.
Yeah, and then you had Spieth and Johnson and McIlroy until he had one bad nine.
Yeah.
You know, they were all there. The difficulty, again, that I have is this notion of using points somehow. Look at, have a winner for each of the first two events. You could even have a winner who gets X amount of prize money for the final event. And then, so you have two columns. Here's what they are in this tournament, and here's what they are overall.
But they had that and went away from that, Bob, a few years. And that was one of the challenges is that, I can't remember what, maybe it was 3 years ago, where one player won the tournament and the other player won the FedEx Cup, and they didn't know who to celebrate. So that becomes, those are the challenges they're fighting through, because they're trying to make the game more understandable, not for the hardcore golf fan, because he's going to watch anyway, but they're trying to grab new viewers, new spectators. And it's they haven't hit the magic elixir yet in order to make it happen. They just haven't. They feel they're getting closer. Obviously FedEx is happy because they continue to sponsor it because of the recognition and the recognition through the whole season.
Well, that's just it. They get a huge amount of recognition all year long.
Across all the networks, you know,
every network, every tournament, every week, 52 weeks.
That's right. So they haven't really hit the home run yet with it. And you watch over the winter before the playoffs start, or before the new season starts, which probably is in, I think, a month. Don't be surprised if we see some tweak again to the FedEx format.
We want to talk about the Canadian soccer team with a reasonably impressive performance again. Blue Jays keep winning. Are they out of it? And the U.S. Open tennis, 3 Canadians, 2 of them in the quarterfinal and another one with a chance to reach the quarterfinal. We'll address all that when we continue after these messages. Bob McCowan, it's John Shannon returning from our extended vacation of a week. I must say, I did miss your face.
No, you did not.
You're right. Okay, I lied. I didn't think about you once.
I know, exactly. When you're hitting that golf ball on the third hole at Taboo, you're not saying, gosh, I wonder what John's doing.
And by the way, I hit the golf ball many times on the third hole at Taboo. As I did with all the other 17 holes.
And off the rocks.
And a couple off the rocks, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Felix Auger-Aliassime has been very impressive in this tournament. He's still young. He's still 21 years old.
Yeah.
I know he was the 12th seed, but he hasn't broken through yet. He hasn't had that big event where he's made a final or won a really significant tournament. And he is a cool customer with oodles of talent. And I mean, you have the number one player in the world, and some will argue the number one player in history in this tournament. And that would be a monumental victory for him. But he has been solid, and I think he is developing a level of confidence that he probably hasn't had before.
But confidence bordering on cockiness, Bob. When you see him playing to the crowd, using his emotions after scoring big points, he's been impressive. There's no question about that. I it's funny, and maybe it's the. Maybe it's a guy like me who is not a hardcore tennis fan, but follows it. And I always follow where Shapovalov ends up before Aliassime. And boy, this guy has been impressive in watching him this week. So it's been fun. It's truly been enjoyable, and to get where he's got and to make the next step. You talk about having a breakthrough. Getting this far in New York City, I think, has to be considered pretty close to a breakthrough, because I like Wimbledon better than the U.S. Open, but this is the U.S. Open, and he's made an impact. He's created new fans for Canadian tennis in both countries, and it's really been fun to watch.
Meanwhile, Leila Fernandez turns 19 years of age today.
Today, yeah.
And she has now beaten, in back-to-back matches, multi-major champions. And her win over Kerber was dramatic, and yet it was pretty decisive, especially in the third set.
Right.
And she is tiny, too. That is the other thing about her. I don't know what she weighs, but she can't weigh much more than 100, 110 pounds, can she?
I don't know. You're not wrong.
I mean, I'm not the weight guessing guy from the Canadian National Exhibition. You remember that?
Sure. Yeah. I always won. I always got him. I always
say about 100, Anna. Yeah. But she is tiny, and that is not the stereotypical kind of player who wins in women's tennis today. You don't have to be a gigantic, but if you look at the most of the champions in women's tennis, most of them have been either, well, tall at the very least. And she is fairly normal height. She might be a little bit taller than normal, but and tiny, but hits the ball like crazy. And these two victories are about as impressive back-to-back victories as you could possibly ask for. And it raises the question now, will she be able to ratchet up her game once again against an opponent who isn't, you know, a former number one?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that now, Bob. When you think of both the victory against Osaka and Kerber, her tenacity, particularly in the Osaka match, to me was phenomenal. She played smart. She played simple. And I'll tell you what, for a body that size, the ball velocity was amazing to me. That was what was really impressive.
She hits it hard.
And was able, she moved her opponent across the court a number of times. It was so impressive. Here's the great thing. So we're not the greatest tennis country in the world, but we have two women in the 16s, and America only has one.
Well, yeah, it's a one-time thing. I mean, hopefully it continues.
Well, but I will tell you right now, I think that, you know, Tennis Canada has done a really good job in building the program and
fantastic
and doing what it had to do to make Canada have presence on the international stage, and between Layla and Bianca, it's been an impressive tournament so far. Although I will tell you what, the first night for Bianca, you wondered if she was going to get through the game.
Well, she's played poorly since she's come back from injuries, and this is the first event that she's actually played pretty well in. And Bianca Andreescu will play tonight.
Yes.
For those that are watching during the day and on a Monday, she has the last match, I think, of the night, so you better get ready to stay up late. But what is intriguing to me is, and you talked about the development of Canadian tennis, it sort of in many ways parallels basketball. We now have, I don't even know how many, 12, 15 Canadians playing in the NBA, where...
Actually, 25, Bob.
Are there 25?
25 Canadians playing in the NBA, yeah.
Wow. This is a relatively new phenomenon. And 10, 15 years ago, you may have had one or two. You had Steve Nash, and I don't even remember anybody else. I mean, there were a few.
Jamal.
Glor was there, yeah. But there were a few. Now you got two dozen.
Yeah. Yeah.
And tennis is starting to show a kind of similar response. And I don't know whether it's who it's from. Is it Raonic as the motivator and the success that he had early in his career? You know, John McEnroe thought Raonic was going to be the number one player in the world at some point. And maybe he would have been if it hadn't been for, you know, mm-hmm. the just one injury after another. But it is really intriguing how it's not just that the game has grown, but that good athletes are now drawn to the sports when Canada has some success.
Yeah. I'd give Jeannie Bouchard some credit too.
Her too. Yeah.
You know,
remember, although her stock rose and fell very quickly.
No, but
she didn't make it to the final at Wimbledon.
But the key thing there isn't final success. The key thing there is who inspired Andreescu and Fernandez to play the game. Who turned them on to the game? And Jeannie got so much attention. You know, she became the darling of Canadian sports for a little while, and the darling of in many ways of the tennis world, whether it be in Australia or in Europe, as well as here, that it's those types of people that inspire young athletes to get involved in the game and say, I want to do that. And I want to be a difference maker. The other thing is, And I know this is a blanket statement. We've always had great athletes. We have rarely had killer instinct. And that's the difference in so many ways is who has the killer instinct. When you go on whether it be the golf course or the basketball court or the hockey rink or the tennis court, do you have that sense to just win? I'm not sure that's something that is natural. I'm not sure that's something that's trained, but we haven't had that ability to have that killer instinct. We see it in Brooke Henderson in golf. Brooke Henderson has the killer instinct. I think we're seeing more and more on the international stage, Canadian athletes having that killer instinct for so long, we were always just viewed as, well, there's the Canadian, they're nice, they're going to get to a certain point and then they're not going to win. But we are now developing great athletes, and we're developing great athletes with killer instinct.
Well, we will see how Ms. Andreescu does this evening, and perhaps three Canadians in the quarterfinals of the U.S. Open. That'd be extraordinary.
Wow. Yeah.
Meanwhile, the Canadian soccer team, in their bid to get back to a World Cup, went into Nashville, Tennessee to play the 10th ranked, I believe they are, U.S. team. Mm-hmm. And went in as a significant underdog. Canada, I think, is ranked 59th now, even though they've played well of late and the program is on the rise. They're still only 59th in the world. They did not play well in the first half. I actually watched a good portion of this game, John.
What? Shocked. What? Come on.
I did. And the first half was totally dominated by the U.S. side in terms of ball possession, which, you know, really means very little. Yes, the U.S. had a few scoring chances. They did rattle one off the post. But then finally they scored in the second half, and you just kind of got the feeling, well, that's going to be it. Because mm-hmm. this Canadian team really spent very little time in the first 50 minutes in the U.S. end.
That wasn't the case for the last 40.
But then they came, then all of a sudden, mm-hmm. the roles were completely reversed. And you could maybe argue that the U.S. had more chances overall, that overall the U.S. team maybe was a better team. But Canada walks away with a 1-1 tie. Same score as the first game against Honduras. And I think we were all kind of disappointed that they only tied Honduras at home in the first game. But you had to be happy.
Oh, yeah.
That they came away with a 1-1 draw in Nashville.
Well, and I'll tell you what, after the Davies cross to learn that to tie the game, I would tell you that Canada had better scoring chances.
Well, I agree.
I think that there were a couple of times, there was a couple of crosses that there just wasn't the ability to finish. But to me, there were two things about it were striking to me because I was curious. Yes, I think that John Erdman's done a really good job with this team. I really wanted to see Alphonso Davies play. I must admit I don't watch him in the German league. I didn't watch him very much in MLS. I wanted to see what everybody was talking about, and particularly in the second half, you got a real sense of his foot skills. You got a real sense of his speed.
He's quick.
Oh, and the other thing that happened was you really got a sense of his competitive nature. And I think you got a real sense of the competitive level of this Canadian team in the second half because they played well at both ends of the field. They defended really well. I was quite impressed. You know, they got a big game on Wednesday night against El Salvador. That I think is going to be important if they expect to get to the World Cup. You know, you can't live with draws all the time, Bob.
Oh no, you got to start winning.
You got to start winning.
But there's 16 games, I think, or 14 games.
14, yeah, 14
games.
Yeah.
In this tournament, there's time. There's no reason to panic because you got two draws. Technically, Canada is tied for third right now with a bunch of teams. But the top three get in to the World Cup and the fourth team gets another chance.
Yeah.
Now you don't want to be number four. You don't want to go through that mess again. And then wind up disappointed. But
I find it interesting though, that they're talking about home field advantage. They're setting dates for tournament games in this tournament in October and November. And there's a good chance that two of the games Canada will host will be in Edmonton in November.
Eek.
No, that's good for us.
Oh, no, it's good for us. Yeah, it's bad for the Central American teams who, come up and go, holy cow.
Well, our guys usually are, they have to go down early in order to try, if they can, with their team commitments, but they go down to adjust to the humidity and the temperature. I wonder what happens for other teams to come to Edmonton in November to adjust to the temperature in the Alberta capital.
Although here's what you have to remember, that there are many players from Central America who play in Europe.
Yes.
And they play during the winter.
Yeah.
And it's not always, it's not 0 degrees Celsius very often. But it's not hot. Mm-hmm. If you're playing in the Premier League, Premiership, or if you're playing in Germany or, wherever in Europe, it's chilly, especially at night. Yeah. So, we have to take that into consideration. These are not guys who all play in 90 degrees every day.
That was an impressive crowd last night, too, in Nashville. Like, I think it was 36.
40,000 nearly.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't see enough masks, but that's just me.
Hardly any.
Yeah, but they always talk about how the you know, soccer in North America needs to make the next step. I'll tell you what, it's done a marvelous job in growing the game, and there really is a pretty good fan base in the United States, and you hope that that fan base continues to grow in Canada. They had 15,000 for the last game. I expect that they'll have a full sellout at BMO, a sellout in the COVID world at BMO on Wednesday.
BMO holds what, about 28?
Yeah. Yeah.
It'd be nice if they could fill the joint. Now, it's not because of lack of interest, I'm sure. I suspect that all the tickets would be sold. Mm-hmm. But with COVID, these are the restrictions that we have, which in many ways seems a little silly to me. Because if you're going to only limit it to 15,000, wouldn't you mandate that you spread them out throughout the stadium?
Yes, that's what's supposed to happen.
But it doesn't.
I know.
Everybody winds up sitting together.
I know.
And you got big chunks of empty space. You know, at some point, maybe somebody from politics ought to look and say, well, if they're all going to sit together, if we can't separate them and keep them distant, then just let them fill it up.
Well, you know, but after the 22nd of September, you know, you're going to have your you know, you're in Ontario, at least your vaccine passport to play. And then you can probably put more people in the building, right? One would think.
Well, one would think, but I'm well beyond trying to anticipate how the government is going to react to anything COVID related. Meanwhile, the Toronto Blue Jays are not done yet. We'll take a look at their performance over the weekend and over the last week since last we were here and assess their chances of moving on when we continue after these messages. McCowan and Shannon with you. You can make a case, John, for Robbie Ray winning a Cy Young. The problem is, this is just my assessment. I think Robbie Ray's the kind of pitcher you got to watch pitch to really appreciate how good he is. Mm-hmm. His statistics are up there, top 3-4 in the American League, maybe in all of baseball. But he's not a big name. He's playing for a team that is trying to get to the postseason, but probably has underachieved a bit. I think, I may be wrong in this, but I think when a starting pitcher comes out of a game after 6 or 7 innings, and that's generally where Robbie Ray is, somewhere in that neighborhood, and then the bullpen gives up a boatload of runs, I think that actually hurts the reputation of the starting pitcher. Because I think there are people out there who don't watch the Blue Jays on a regular basis, but maybe take a look at the line score at the end of a game. And maybe don't specifically look at his line score. They look at the team's line score. And Robbie Ray goes out there and gives up, you know, theoretically, you know, 2 runs on 5 hits. But then the other team comes back against the Blue Jays bullpen and scores 4 or 5 runs. I think that hurts Robbie Ray. And so I'm not anticipating that the guy will win the Cy Young Award. But this Dave Steeb, Doc Halliday, Roger Clemens in his 2 years, and Robbie Ray, I can't think of anybody else I put in that category in terms of how impressive he has been. Now, granted, over the course of 1 year.
Yeah. And the other three, when you think about it, I think nobody really knows Ray the way they know the other three guys you talked about. I mean, the other guys, by the time...
Well, they did it over a period of time.
They had a reputation.
Yeah, Clemens came with a reputation. Steve and Halliday built theirs in Toronto.
Sure. I mean, what is he... how many strikeouts now? 210, 220? I mean, his numbers are spectacular. The team seems to play better behind him. I mean, that's the other thing. And the confidence his teammates have in him, too. Is part of
they score runs.
Yeah. Listen, when you win games 10-8, 10-8, and 8-0 over a weekend against Oakland, a team you have to beat anyway, This is the way I imagined the Blue Jays were going to play series against teams all season long. Friday night. Have you seen anything like Friday night before, Bob?
That was pretty weird.
I mean, when you think about, 8-2, load the bases, walk one in, grand slam, and then get to the bottom of the ninth. That was, to me, that was, holy smokes, that was pretty impressive.
Oh, the whole weekend was very impressive, offensively and clutch hitting, not just racking up runs. Yesterday, the Sunday game was 8-0. They scored, I think, 3 in the second and 4 in the third. So it was, with Robbie Ray on the mound, you figured, well, it's pretty much put to bed. So it wasn't a matter of clutch hitting necessarily. But Robbie Ray has now struck out 10-plus in 4 consecutive starts. Mm-hmm. He is the first Blue Jay pitcher in history to do that. That gives you an idea. Doc didn't do it. I think Clemens did it 2 or 3 times. I got 3 in a row, 3 right. games in a row with 10-plus strikeouts. Robbie Ray's done it 4 times. And, for the longest time, Robbie Ray was part of the group of, we thought, pretty good starters. We talked a lot about Manoah, and Manoah was sort of the shining light. And
Pearson was supposed to be a shining light too.
Well, but we've seen almost nothing of him
right
this year, and we'll see him the rest of this year, I presume. But we'll see him out of the bullpen mm-hmm. exclusively. Robbie Ray is clearly the best pitcher on the Toronto Blue Jays. I mean, 6 weeks ago we would have had a conversation about if the Blue Jays make the postseason, who's your pitcher, starting pitcher in game
Ryu. One? I would have said Ryu.
I probably would have said that too. Now there's no question.
No.
Who it is. Now, Ryu is a more experienced pitcher. He's had success for longer periods of time. But Robbie Ray is as good as anybody in baseball right now.
I tell you what, our buddy, Mr. Atkins, who was on with us a couple weeks back, the two guys he needs to get signed.
Just going to go there.
Simeon and Robbie Ray. Holy smokes. There are more zeros. There are more zeros now on those contracts.
In my mind, the answer is you got to sign both.
Oh, I agree. Otherwise, this season becomes in many ways a wasted season. Even if they don't make the playoffs, they're playing relevant baseball now. They'll probably play relevant baseball until one would hope the last week of the season. But these guys are foundation guys now. And you've got to be able to try to find a way to keep both of them in addition to the other core members of your team.
Well, I mean, people talk a lot about, Guerrero, Bichette are going to be arbitration eligible and they're going to get a whack of dough. And they are. And so are others on this team. Hernandez is going to get paid. Gurriel's going to get paid. Yeah. Gurriel, a guy who I think most people thought, well, he's trade bait. You can do better. Boy, I mean, do you still feel that way about him?
Boy, he's maturing. Even though there's no bigger kid on the team, I think, than Gurriel right now. But boy, he's really showing something in this last little while.
So it's going to cost you $40+ million a year to sign Semien and Ray.
Yeah, yeah.
I think you got to do it.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know you spend a lot of money on the center fielder who, unfortunately has had an injury plagued season. You spent a lot of money on Ryu. Ryu's a $20 million guy. Springer is $25 million. But these two guys deserve that. Mm-hmm. And I think this team deserves that. And the one thing you have to remember, we talk a lot about if they sign these two guys, what do they do with Bichette and Guerrero? Well, you know what? You got 2 years to think about that. And secondly, just because you sign a guy to a contract doesn't mean you can't trade him. So if this team doesn't win something, if they don't gel, if Rogers gets cheap, they're tradable commodities.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And you may not like to see them traded, but because you're signing them doesn't mean you have to keep them and pay them through the entire length of their contract.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, there is something, you can see something with this group of players. You know, Dave Perkins was on a few weeks back and was making fun of the jacket thing, and I can see why the jacket thing would drive certain people nuts. But these guys do have fun as a group. I mean, they seem to have bonded so well. And there's something to be said for that, for success.
Oh God. Yeah. I agree with you.
I mean, every time I can't stop laughing. Every time I see somebody put on the jacket, the first person I think of is Dave Perkins, but, but at the same time, when Alejandro Kirk goes from, first to home, the amount of fun they have with him and toweling him off.
Well, they all seem to really care about each other. Yes. And cheer for each other.
And are
happy for each other.
And listen, remember, this organization over the last decade and a bit, Bob, wasn't necessarily always that way. And this is a group that seems to want to play for each other and seems to be really happy to be back in Toronto playing in front of real Blue Jay baseball fans.
Well, I'll buy that, but I will tell you that I think we both saw a lot of the same kind of enthusiasm in Dunedin and in Buffalo too. Maybe not quite as much, but it was there. This wasn't something that was when they came back home.
I think a lot to be said for, the short season last year and getting to the playoffs and that group of guys having to live together, particularly in their time in Buffalo in 2020.
So they are now tied with Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
They are
imagine the panic in Oakland, though, huh? I was also thinking about this, Bob. And over the last 2 weeks, the amount of consternation in Toronto and the media and the fans not being happy with the Jays, and you always wonder, do other teams have the same issues? Well, they got them, they have them this weekend in Oakland.
Ain't no kidding. So they're a game back of Seattle. They have a 4-game series at Yankee Stadium starting today.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're 4 games back of Boston.
Boston, yes, they are, for the
and
second
5 one. Back of the Yankees? Or is it more?
Might be more. I think it's more, yeah.
And they've now won, I don't even know, 7 of 8, something like that. Go 3-1 against the Yankees, and this thing is on.
Yeah, you just tipped me off to another thing, and it kind of dovetails in with our discussion about playing tennis in New York. If Robbie Ray has one of those outings in New York City at Yankee Stadium, like he's had the 4 consecutive 10 strikeouts, you will see a lot more discussion because it's New York City, because it's the epicenter of professional sports in North America. If he has an impressive outing against the Yankees, you'll hear and see a lot more discussion about Ray and the Cy Young discussion.
I don't think he's going to pitch against the Yankees.
You don't think so? You don't think he'll be
Robbie
one of the
Ray?
Four?
No, yeah. No, won't. Because he pitched yesterday.
I thought they might pitch him in the fourth.
I don't. That's 3 days rest. He won't. Okay. He won't pitch on 3 days rest. He'll pitch Friday, at the earliest.
Okay.
And I would assume Friday. So, you'll get the other 4 starters.
Yeah.
Well, and look, it's not Robbie Ray, but they're all still pretty good. And the Yankees are spinning after winning 13 or whatever it was in a row. They've now lost 6 of 8, I think.
Wow.
So who knows?
I'd go to the McCowan 4-man rotation and play Ray and pitch Ray in the fourth game. So
I go to the 2-man rotation. Spawn insane in 2 days of rain, as they used to say in Milwaukee. Do you want to promote who we have on tomorrow or later in the week, or do you think that's too dangerous?
Too dangerous, always dangerous.
Yeah, because the producer of this program has a really spotty track record of getting people who he thinks he's going to get.
Well,
so we don't want to mention him by name.
No.
And we certainly don't want to point fingers at him. And generally speaking, he does a very good job. Although I think he took today off, which is why you and I are just here by ourselves.
You figure, huh?
Yammering. Well, I suspect.
Okay.
Let me say this much, if I can. If everything goes according to plan, well, pretty good week.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say?
Yes, I do. Absolutely.
And then an announcement of some significance either later this week or at the latest a week from today, wouldn't you say?
I guess. Hopefully before next Monday.
Well, you would think so, but it's out of our control. We are sworn to secrecy, so we're not allowed to tell, but there are plans, and we'll tell you when we have been given permission, because as everybody knows, John and I do exactly what we're told
all the time. Yeah.
Have a nice day, Mr. Shannon. Enjoy your Labor Day. Enjoy baseball, tennis, whatever it is you're watching today.
Oh, I'm going to go to the Argos and Tiger Cats.
I was just going to say, it's the Labor Day Classic in Hamilton, right?
Yes, sir. I'm on my way.
Well, have a nice trip. And say hello to everybody down there for me.
I will do.
That's it for today for Shannon McCallum. Have a swell final day of the long weekend. And we'll see you tomorrow. Bye, everybody.